Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Dr. Zeev Magan joins us, I believe, for the first time on this program, and I'm very pleased to have him with us. He is the former chair of the Department of Middle Eastern History at Bar-Ilan University. He has a similar role today at the Shalem College in Jerusalem. He is also a research associate at the Begin Sadat Center for Strategic Studies and an author many times over, including an important book about the virtues of the flesh, passion, and purity in early Islamic jurisprudence, and a new book shortly to be with us entitled The Mind of the Ayatollahs. He has a PhD from Columbia University, has served in the Israeli Defense Forces, and we are delighted to have him with us to talk a bit about things happening in the neighborhood over there. We catch up with him, I believe, in Israel. Professor Magan, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk to us.
My pleasure.
Well, let's start with the mind of the Ayatollahs, if we could. You're a serious student of Iran. I'm wondering what you think is going on in their minds at the moment. Are they panicking? Do they anticipate that this is the beginning of the end for the mullahocracy, or is this just another bump in the road to the realization of their grand designs to destroy, well, among other things, the little Satan, your country, and mine, the great Satan?
Well, that's a very interesting question. The Ayatollahs, of course, are Shiite Muslims, and Shiite Muslims have a double mentality going, which involves, on the one hand, a feeling of superiority in the Muslim world. They see themselves, despite their minority status, the Shiites are about 10% of the Muslims, and Sunnis are 90% of the Muslims. Nevertheless, Shiites see themselves as the elite. They see themselves as the true Muslims and as the proper leaders of the Muslim world. And that's been something they've been trying to establish themselves as since the revolution in Iran in 1979. On the other hand, Shiites are scared to death. They have been scared to death for 1,400 years. They're a tiny, persecuted, hated minority. And there's been a boomerang effect since their revolution of Sunni extremist Muslim groups sprouting up all over the place and directing their daggers at Iran. So it's not so much the current protests that are scaring them. All the current unrest has fearsome implications for the Ayatollahs, but perhaps not to the same extent as what has always frightened Shiites, and that is that they're a persecuted, hated minority, and they could be wiped out of existence at any time. So, you know, it's this double thing going.
Let me ask you about, even within their own country, there are very substantial numbers of non-Shiites, the Yazidis, the Baluchis, the Kurds among them. Do you anticipate that this is a source of particular concern to the Ayatollahs of the Shiite tradition? And is it a potential fault line that we should be exploiting in the West?
Well, there's no question that the Sunnis in Iran have been, when they are activists, and some of them are activists, they have made some trouble for the regime. The current unrest, on the other hand, is not about Sunnism or about Shiism. It's much more about anti-Islamic Iranian nationalism, kind of harking back both to the Pahlavi Shahs, the kings of the 20th century who tried to westernize, modernize, and de-Islamize Iran, and also all the way back to the pre-Islamic Sasanian and Achaemenid, Cyrus and all those guys. That's scary to the Ayatollahs on a different level, because that's not just the Sunni-Shi'i schism. That's a statement against religion entirely, and it's, in favor of nationalism instead.
And we're seeing some sentiment along these lines, of course, in the protests in the street at the moment. Professor, there's so much more to talk about Iran, and perhaps we can come back to you soon about that as this story continues to develop. But I did want to ask you in the remainder of our time with you about Israel and some rather important changes, it would appear, in American policy, not only from Barack Obama to Donald Trump with respect to U.S. relations with the Jewish state, but more to the point, U.S. policy towards the Palestinians. It's been rather breathtaking from my perspective, and I'd like to get your sense of it when you look at Donald Trump's reaction to the Palestinians and others criticizing him and voting against him in the United Nations when he recognized the reality of Israel's capital being Jerusalem and moved our embassy there. And, you know, the possibilities of cutting off the Palestinians from U.S. financial support and UNRWA, this U.N. relief agency as well. And even the U.S. ambassador, David Friedman, tweeting just today, I think, that, you know, the problem with peace that is eluding the Jews and the Palestinians is the Palestinians support terrorism against the Jews. Talk about whether this really represents kind of a tectonic shift towards what my friend Daniel Pipes has called the Israel victory strategy, perhaps. A very different approach than what we've seen out of U.S. administrations, Republican and Democratic, in the past.
Again, speaking not as an expert, but as an Israeli citizen, and looking across the Atlantic, I can say that Donald Trump is sui generis. He is unique in the history of U.S. and world politics. I like him a lot for that reason, although many others do not. He's a guy who says what's on his mind, and he cuts through a lot of the bull and gets to the heart of the matter. And he isn't easily swayed by all those who say you can't do this and you can't do that, and this is against our, you know, State Department tradition, and this is against diplomatic norms, and et cetera. He goes right to the heart of the matter, and certainly as an Israeli, I can appreciate where he's gone with this. And I think Daniel Pipes is right that in Israel, we're not just following Trump here, but there is a Trump effect that Israelis are tired of constantly suggesting compromises to the other side and having them not only not be accepted, but having them answered by, you know, massacre and murder, and instead come out and say, you know what, this is our land, and we've earned it, and you know, we have no desire to displace anybody or hurt anyone else, but we're going to defend our land. And I think, yeah, that is a shift. There's no question about it. I see the shift here in Israel. There's a lot less apologizing going on than there was in recent years.
I appreciate your modesty on the subject, but you pass for an expert for the moment with us. Do you think that this actually conduces to a difference in this so-called peace process? Or does it simply conduce to a heightened likelihood of peace simply because, with or without a process, there will be a new recognition of the reality that Israel does, in fact, control the territory and by right should, given its military victories?
I don't know about the by right should part. I don't think we're ever going to convince the other side of that. But I think you're right. I think that anyone who kind of dabbles in game theory or looks back at history can figure out that, for instance, when the Muslims signed treaties that were long-lasting with other powers like the Austro-Hungarian Empire or any other element in the medieval or modern West, it was always because those countries put up a wall, an impregnable kind of iron wall that the Muslims finally had to stop charging ahead and engaging in jihad. And when they saw that they could not prevail, they signed treaties. It's actually something that goes way back to the Prophet Muhammad. He did the same thing when he saw he couldn't prevail. I think it's a natural human thing to do, but it's certainly attested in Muslim history. And I think that, you know, one of our great Zionist theoreticians and pioneers, a fellow by the name of Ze'ev Jabotinsky, his prescription was an iron wall. If you want peace, an iron wall will lead to peace.
A fascinating point at a very moment where we're talking about a wall here in this country as well, as you know. We have to leave it at that for the moment. I'm sorry to say thank you so much for joining us and for the work you're doing at the Shalom College in Jerusalem. We look forward with great anticipation to your new book, The Mind of the Ayatollahs, and hope you'll join us again in the near future. Next up, we'll speak with Christine Douglas-Williams about Canada and what is likely to happen there and here with freedom of speech and more. Straight ahead.
go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.